from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Bay Area football fans remember Steve Young as the Hall of Fame quarterback who led the San Francisco 49ers to a Super Bowl victory in 1995, throwing a record-setting 6 touchdown passes. But less well-known are Young's struggles with anxiety, which he writes about in his new memoir, QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. Young joins us in the studio to talk about his life in football, his relationship with Joe Montana, and his Mormon faith. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. More than once during his rise, Hall of Fame quarterback Steve Young nearly walked away from football, like when he was an eighth-string quarterback at BYU with a coach who said he'd never make it because he was a lefty, or after he signed the largest contract in sports history and felt overwhelmed by impossible expectations. The two-time NFL MVP and Super Bowl MVP writes about these struggles, as well as his legendary triumphs, in his new memoir, QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. It's a life 49ers fans might be surprised to learn was beset by anxiety, at times so intense it threatened to sideline him. Steve Young finally did walk away from football when a concussion ended his career at the age of 37. Steve Young, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And congratulations on the book.
Yeah. Everyone says that. Congratulations. And I'd like, it seems like, is it congratulations because you finished it I'm a first time author. So I was like, oh, thank you. Congratulations. I don't know. It's a funny thing there, but everyone says the same thing.
Well, I think it's quite an accomplishment, right? And particularly a book that you've written where you really looked at some pretty hard moments in your life. And one of the things I also read was that you initially wanted to write this for your kids.
So, yeah, I think it's probably good to go from the beginning. So I finished playing in 2000 and my first son was born in 2000. So he had as he grew up, we live in the Bay Area, so he would go to school, and his dad obviously was someone that was well known, and he had to get used to hearing people say things like, "Oh, your dad did this," or "Your dad did that," and he'd come home and say, "Dad, is that true?" And I'd think, a lot of the times, I'd be like, "No, it's not true," and so I started thinking, "Oh my gosh, my children," and we had four children, as they were going through school and really in throughout their lives, they're going to hear about their dad. They have no affiliation; weren't around. With that time. And I just got thinking, I need to write my story for them. And that's where this started. This did not start as a book. This didn't start as a project for anything other than to hand a narrative of some kind that I could give to the kids. And so when I, a close friend I was talking to one day about this dilemma that I was in, and he said, "I have a guy that I think could help you, Jeff Benedict." And I'd never heard of Jeff. And he's a writer, and he's somebody that maybe could help you kind of collect your stories, collect what you have to say, collect things. And so I called him and engaged that with him to go and talk to my family, talk to my friends, talk to teammates, coaches, and just see if you can't put a narrative together for my children. And literally hand – and I didn't even know what it would look like. I didn't know if it would be a box. I didn't know if it would be just a collection of I didn't know how it would look. Yeah. But Jeff decided that he was going to write it in chapters. And I thought, this is scary. And that's the beginning. That's how it started.
And a big theme that runs through this is your struggle with anxiety and eventually how you overcame it. Those moments I mentioned at the top of the introduction about BYU after you signed your first contract also with USFL, those two moments, how much did anxiety play a role in your decisions? Or you didn't make a final decision, but you were very close to making a final decision to walk away.
Yeah.
How much of a role did anxiety play?
So it's hard to know how fundamental things in your life inform everything that you do, but it's there. And so I think what I wrote was my experience not knowing that I had a pretty severe case of separation anxiety, as I found out. And now I found out that it kind of runs in my mom's family. It's kind of a thing that is sprinkled around. And And for me, it showed up early in my life when no one really knew. And even my family, I would, like in first grade, I wouldn't go to school. And so my parents were like, well, you got to go to school. And I didn't know how to express that I was scared to go to school. And really what I was saying is, I don't want to leave home. And that's common for kids that have separation anxiety.
Yeah, you wrote that your mom ended up having to stay at school for the whole day.
She would walk me to school and stay until I got more used to it. And what happened, and it was much later in my life that I realized what I was trying to replicate was home. And when I felt at home, things were okay. But when I felt away from home, it was very full of anxious moments. And so after a few weeks, she stopped having to come because I obviously felt like first grade was now a place that I could be home. And then second grade, I remember very vividly being picked up by my dad after school and driving to my aunt's house where we were going to stay for the weekend while my parents went away. The idea of my parents going away was just overwhelming, and I didn't know how to express it. And so they did go away. And I had one of the worst, most traumatic weekends of my life, you know, with the fear and anxiety that was around that weekend. And so as I look back through my life and say those fundamental memories should have been more informative, but you get over. My parents come back. I'm like, oh, okay, that's over. And during the days, I was, you know, great. I was playing sports. I was doing well in school. But at night, I'm home. Yes. And so that idea of home plays out as you watch me try to make the transition to college, which was death-defying to me, and then finding home there, and then now trying to go pro and have a new home, right. And that transition. So the transitions particularly were – and I even think, you know, the transitions that you know, takes time. But then why would I choose a profession that would put me in front of 80,000 people every week? And then not only that, take on the pressures of Jim McMahon in college, one of the great college quarterbacks that ever played.
BYU, yeah.
And Joe Montana. Like, how did I find my way to get into these situations that were, you know, people around me were saying, boy, you seem to have a lot of anxiety about it, but I would even have more. And I'd be thinking, I've found ways to actually expand on this theme to make it more, you know, crazier than it even could be. And that's part of the story.
Right. Yeah. Your coping mechanisms were, or you're forced to cope, really, in some ways. As you mentioned, when you were at BYU, you were able to, rather than stay in the dorm, you stayed at somebody's home.
Right. I was like always looking for a home.
Kids.
You know, and my parents did know that. My dad, you know, throughout my life, my dad would always, whenever I would struggle, he'd like, Steve, I mean, you've got a great life. Especially when I was playing pro football, he loved football. He loves football even more than me. He's like, this is my dream. You're playing football. You're getting paid to play a game. Go have fun. And I'm like, fun? Like, we just never connected because in that way, genetic anxiety, I don't think it makes sense to people that don't have it. It just makes – it's disconnected.
There was a story you wrote about that particularly struck me, which was, you know, you had – walked onto the team at BYU. You wanted to be a quarterback. The coach at that time said you'll never be a quarterback, right, because right. You're a lefty and you can't throw, which is kind of amazing now, about what we know about you now. But you packed your bag and you called your dad and you said, I'm quitting and I'm coming home. And your dad said, you can quit, but you can't come home because we won't have a quitter in our house.
It was – and he was serious. His nickname is Grit and he means it. Like it's like – he has gold teeth and he kind of, you know, like he's a teddy bear, but he's very serious about certain things. And quitting was one of them, you know. And the truth is, when I went to school across the country from Connecticut, I didn't unpack my bags ever for the first semester. They stayed packed. And early on in that first summer camp for football, I was the eighth string quarterback. I didn't know that when I took the scholarship, and BYU at that time was a school that was one of the few schools that threw the football. Most colleges were running the football. And so it was highly sought after for quarterbacks who wanted to go pro because that Stanford and Miami were the three places where you could kind of be tutored in the pro game. And so I found myself in the middle of all these guys from all the country. And so I found myself eighth string. And so eighth string really means that I was the quarterback that prepared our defense for that week's game. So I was the quarterback for the opposing team during the week. And I always joke that defensive players, not the smartest guys in the world, didn't actually realize that I wasn't the quarterback for the team. You know, they really beat on me pretty good. And I think that was the one I called my dad. Because I wanted, deep down, I wanted to go home. Regardless of how bad it was going in football, I wanted comfort. When you feel anxious, you want relief. And relief was home. And so I always constantly was being pushed away from that. And that's why I always say go through it, because you're being pushed to do things that are not comfortable. And you always want comfort. And so that's when I called him. I felt like I had a good enough story for him to buy. Like, this is how bad it is, Dad. This is how bad it's going. And even you would see that this is that I need to come home. And when he said that to me, I thought to myself, well, I really have nowhere else to go. And so
you stuck
it out. I think I'm going to stick it out. And I think it's informative as I parent, and really for anybody. There, you know, that doesn't mean that every time as a parent you'd say, I don't care how hard. It's not a lesson, but it's just informative for that moment. I would have come home if he said, you're right, Steve. This is not working out. You come home and we'll deal with this later. I would have taken my bag, which was already packed, and headed home. And that would have changed my life, probably not for the best.
We're talking with NFL Hall of Famer and former 49ers quarterback Steve Young. His autobiography with Jeff Benedict is called QB, My Life Behind the Spiral, and it details his struggle with anxiety. And Steve Young, could I ask you to read a passage from your book?
Sure.
And this is a passage that you wrote after you were with the 49ers for some years. And I want you to read this particular one because I think it really gives a sense of how intense and paralyzing the anxiety was for you, even as an adult who, you know, you'd already been MVP at this point. And just to set it up, the passage I'm asking you to read is the first home game since Joe Montana was traded to Kansas City. It's September 1993. You haven't slept for 40 hours. You've been vomiting. And there are signs everywhere of love for Joe Montana and no signs of love for you among the fans at Candlestick, and this is the game against the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah, that's good. That's good context. And so I'll start. We hang on to win 37-30, but on our final play, I'm struck on the side of the head, and I feel something pop in my neck. I walk off the field gingerly. Despite being sleep-deprived, famished, and hampered by a jammed neck from the blow to the head, I have one of the best games of my career, completing 18 of 22 passes for 210 yards and 3 touchdowns. I also rush for 52 yards and catch one of my own passes. I stagger to the training room. This is a little more dramatic. Okay, so I stagger to the training room where I undergo a neurological exam. Sorry about that. Dr. Clint tells me that I have jammed neck and a mild concussion. After some electrostimulation, he gives me an anti-inflammatory and puts a cervical soft collar on my neck. But my neck is the least of my problems. My emotions are on the surface, and I don't want anyone to see me this way. I lie on my back on the training table until everyone except Dr. Clint is gone. Then I sit up. Reggie, can I talk to you? He looks at me. Dry sweat and grass stains coat my skin. My hair is matted from my helmet. You look like you haven't slept in days, he says. I haven't. He closes the training room door. Steve, what's going on? I bury my face in my hands and start to shake. It's okay, Steve, he whispers. Reggie, I'm really struggling. Yeah, I know. I start sobbing. What's wrong with me, Reggie? He puts his arms around me. I'm sure this doesn't make any sense to you, I continue. Steve? What? I understand, he whispers. I had bouts of this all through my days in medical school. I look up. Reggie is crying. I know all about anxiety, he says. I understand how it works. Is that what this is? I ask. I hug him and wipe my eyes.
Steve Young reading from QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. How much of a relief was it to know that you had a thing?
It was the difference. There was nothing more valuable. Even following for years, there was nothing more valuable than understanding that, first of all, it's genetic, that it's in my mom's family, that this is somewhat common, that, just putting a name to understanding what the feelings were. It meant the world to me to, to, and it was a relief. It was a tremendous relief. It didn't make it. It was still hard. I mean, it doesn't go away. You know, it. I think over the years of playing, it waned to a point where I just, you know, it doesn't really affect my life at all anymore.
Sure, but even the doctor, once you started to actually see a doctor for anxiety specifically. Right. The doctor said, I have never seen an adult with this kind of separation anxiety. He was just saying that you had a particularly...
Well, it was, you know, he had 10 questions. And if you said yes to 5 of them, he diagnosed you with this separation anxiety, this genetic separation anxiety. Childhood. That's undiagnosed in adults a lot of times. And he said, and so I said yes to 9. And the 10th one was a question I couldn't answer because he said, do you have nightmares about... And I just... I didn't. I don't know that I did, or you know, I don't remember my dreams very well. So I've never been great at that. And so he said, Steve, I got to be honest with you. People that I run into that have this, you know, what I would say a more severe case of childhood separation anxiety, that are diagnosed as adults, usually they're not MVPs of the NFL. And I don't really know what to do with you. And I said, well, I don't know that I really need you to do much with me. You've already done it in a way. It's just so powerful. Because all the years that I played, I felt like it was outsized. I'd see others that were nervous or felt, you know, everyone gets butterflies. And so I, you know, but I always, my good friend, John Taylor, who I played for years, he could laugh in pregame. He could laugh on the bus. He could laugh on the plane. He could laugh in the huddle. He could laugh as he scored a touchdown. Everything was funny and enjoyable to him. And he was my dream. It was a dream to be John Taylor and just laugh your way through it all, and how much I was not laughing through it.
And you didn't, once it was diagnosed, take medication for it.
Well, I tried briefly, and it just made me feel like a blanket was over my head. It didn't help, you know. And so for me, the knowledge was the key. And I'm not saying – I think it's important that it can help and be a lifesaver for many people. So I don't – as I realize, especially after this book, that there's so many that have come to me and said, Steve, my son, my daughter, me, I've struggled with these kinds of things. And I just – I want people to know that I don't – my way is not the way that I suggest for anybody. But for me, the knowledge was the key, and the medicine really just made me feel like – it didn't help.
Well, what also probably didn't help was the fact that you were brought into the 49ers to basically follow Joe Montana. And you thought when you came in that you would be a starting quarterback because Joe Montana was hurt. So here you are coming in to essentially then become the backup, right, for one of the greatest quarterbacks, if not the greatest of all time.
Of course.
So people would say, was there any part of you that resented head coach Bill Walsh after he kind of lured you to San Francisco?
Sure, of course. I mean, it was really hard because I'd come from a really lousy team,
and you need
a lot of help in the NFL to be good. Anyone who says I'm great and I don't need any help is lying. You need a lot of help in football, and that's why it makes football so unique and different. That's why I say it's the great team game, because you need so much help. And so joining the 49ers, the opportunity when Bill worked me out when they were trying to work out the trade, and his pitch was, because the pitch, if the original pitch was, Steve, Joe's one of the great players of all time, we'd like you to come learn from him, and then at some point in the future maybe you play, I honestly would have maybe petulantly, not realizing that was a great opportunity, would have said no, because I knew that I didn't want to watch. I'd rather go to law school, to be honest with you, than watch. And so that wouldn't have worked. But he didn't try that. He said to me, Steve, Joe's had his second back surgery and there's no way that he can continue. And not that I was – I had no – I was sad, I didn't – I was sorry to hear about
poorly,
that.
Yes.
Right. But we'd love you to come and kind of take his place. And I thought that was a great honor to think that I could do that. And so I made the decision to come to San Francisco feeling this honor to come and actually get in the huddle with this great team and try to, you know, step into the shoes of Joe Montana, which I knew would be big. Little did I know, the first practice, the team that came out, which is this famous team of, you know, at that point it was Ronnie Lott and Jerry Rice and Roger Craig and Tom Rathman, and, you know, you go on and on, Randy Cross and, I mean, Michael Carr. It was the Super Bowl teams of the 80s. And Joe was the last one to come out. And I remember seeing him for the first time, and immediately what I thought to myself, oh, my gosh, he's not hurt. And I thought, it's too late now. And I remember telling Bill many times, Bill, why didn't you tell me that he was like fine? And not only fine, he went on to win multiple MVPs,
right? I mean,
multiple
amazing,
Super Bowls. In the middle of it, I'm trying to dig through my career and say to myself, I refuse to have it go down where I don't play. And so luckily I played enough and played successfully so that it became, you know, I found some solace in getting on the field enough. But Joe and I did recently a commercial together, which it was never toxic between the two of us. It was never, we never had a crossword. We never argued. We had thousands of hours together in meeting rooms and buses and planes and trains and everywhere. We supported each other the best we could. And I've said many, many times, it went as well as it could have gone. But it was always awkward. And we did a commercial recently titled Awkward. And it was a really, I think, an embodiment of our time together. It was always awkward because there was one job and two guys.
One of my colleagues in the newsroom, Alex Helmick, had this question that he wanted me to ask you, which I thought was so great. What's one of the worst things you heard from fans when you became the starter over Montana that you can say on the radio?
Well, it was – first of all, you have to – if you're going to survive something like that, you have to take it in context. You can't, if everything's going to eat at you, and I tried to insulate myself from a lot of it because it was impossible. I'd be on the bread line at the grocery store and the woman behind me would be talking to the person next to her and she'd be like, Steve Young's trying to play for Joe Montana. He's horrible. I'm like, I'm in the bread line. Can I just get some groceries? You turn on the radio, you know? And so I think the things that hurt the most were the things that were unfair. Like, anyone that said Joe's the greatest was like, of course he is, you know, and Steve's horrible. Yeah, it's an opinion. It's fine. But there were some things that felt like personal, you know, like there's something that went to my talent and things like I would take them personally. Like I'm a good player. Like when my mom would yell into the stands, you know, to people when they'd boo me, you know, like he's a good player. You know, I think those are the ones that hurt the most when the people think I could do the job. And they, you know, the banners and there was. I mean, you go back. Remember, there was the famous for me famous. Probably no one else remembers, but headline in the Chronicle right after the Gulf War broke out. It says, "What's the Gulf War? It's Steve Young's fault." Meaning, like. Everything must, you know, it's,
yeah.
Everything's
so really
his fault.
Kind of put,
yeah.
put
maybe that's the
on
one
it.
That hurt the most. Your question from your producer is like the headline in the Chronicle, the Gulf War.
No,
Steve
they
Young's fault.
Probably were also saying that maybe you were getting, you were getting more than you deserve. We're talking with NFL Hall of Famer and former 49ers quarterback Steve Young. His new memoir is QB: My Life Behind the Spiral, which details his struggles with anxiety, his relationship with Joe Montana. And we'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation with Steve Young. What are your questions or comments for him? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Post them on Facebook, or you can tweet us at KQED Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Stay with us.
To throw. In trouble. He's going to be sacked. No, gets away. He runs, gets away again, goes to the 40, gets away again, to the 35, cuts back at the 30, to the 20, the 50, the 10. He dives. Touchdown, 49ers.
That is tape of Steve Young's famous run against Minnesota in 1988. Steve Young, of course, NFL Hall of Famer and former 49ers quarterback. In that particular piece of tape, the 49ers were trailing 21-17 with less than 2 minutes left. Young ducked and spun away from an avalanche of a pass rush and galloped downfield 49 yards for the winning touchdown. He stumbled at the 8-yard line and was going down, but managed to get into the end zone with a lurching drive.
It was a lurch.
with a lurching dive. And the thing that was so great also about this game that you wrote about was that you were booed at the start of it when you were coming out, and then you were the hero at the end of it, which once again shows just how you needed to earn the respect of San Francisco fans. And speaking of that, how, I mean, it must have been just incredible to be able to put questions to rest about your legitimacy to take the quarterback job after Joe Montana when you won the Super Bowl as the starting quarterback.
And there's no question. And I think it was an odyssey. It was a journey. I don't know how to describe it any other way in dealing with expectations. And no matter, you know, we deal with them all the time, no matter what. But I had these outsized expectations. Sometimes I would have to tell people, teammates, that, you know, Joe did throw an interception. You know, he actually lost a game. Like I sometimes felt like I had to come out with the data, like to actually prove that something bad happened. I felt that way a lot. And so the expectations were like, felt like a mountain. And there was no way that I could, and I tried. I was so invested in the effort to try to deal with it and overcome it and to show that I could stand in those shoes. And so it was, that's how it felt until about 1991, when I had a really seminal conversation with Steve Covey. I didn't mean to have it. It was on the plane. I just happened to sit down next to him. He's the one that wrote all the Seven Habits books. And I unloaded all this on him. Oh my gosh, this is so hard. This is so difficult. I'm in the middle of a season. No one, I'm overinvested. Everyone on football on the team is underinvested. I'm the one that's taking all the blame. I told him about the headline in the Chronicle. Football's too many people. This is too much to take. No one can deal with this. I've had it, you know. I don't know why. You know, you ever sat next to someone on their plane and you just do that? Like, it all comes out. Yeah. He listened quietly and said, then he said, when I was done, he said, Steve, let me ask you a couple questions, because I truly understand what you're saying. There are too many people in football. He had this theory that 7 is the magic number for interaction between human beings. And once it add an eighth person, the it would devolve the organization and the work together, unity. And so he said 11 is way too many. Basketball works great. Football doesn't work. So I understand what you're saying. But truly, let me ask you a couple questions. If the 49ers, they're one of the best. I'm not a great fan of football, but they seem like one of the better organizations in football. And he said, yeah, they are. And I says, your coach, he's one of the great oh, my gosh, yes. And Joe Montana's on the team, right? And I said, yes, he is. That's the problem. And he goes, well, no, if you asked him, if you were able to ask him a question, you know, kind of as a tutor, could you get the mentorship from him? And I said, well, yeah, if I wanted to, he'd answer the question. He goes, Steve, I travel the world. I look everywhere in corporations, anywhere for platforms where people can be successful, platforms that allow people to see how good they can get. I got to be honest with you. As I travel the world and hear your story, the San Francisco 49ers and where you are right now might be one of the great platforms that I've ever seen for anybody to ever have to see how good you can get. My world turned upside down at that moment. So I looked at the whole struggle differently from then on.
Do you think then that you would have had a Hall of Fame career had you not been forced to be backup for Joe Montana?
I think that you build those expectations. You build an expectation in your mind. I think I had excellence in my head. I wanted to be great. I wanted to be Roger Staubach as I grew up. That was in my – so I knew I had excellence in my head. But I think looking back, I say the worst thing that ever happened to me is I had to back up Joe Montana, but the best thing that ever happened to me, because I watched him and I had to say, wow, how do I get there? And by witnessing it, I think it – to your point, Nina, I think it helped me – the expectations, so that whatever I did accomplish, if it wasn't to the excellence, I knew it wasn't enough. Like, I didn't settle. It kept me moving. So by the way, you mentioned to the original question about the Super Bowl, it was a huge relief to know that the Bay Area, if you were going to be any good in the Bay Area, you better win a Super Bowl.
Well, let's hear what our listeners have to say. Wynn in Menlo Park. Hi, Wynn.
Hi. Thank you very much, Steve, for all of your legion of fans. You've been a great inspiration for all of us and gave us a lot of thrills. But my question is, one of the iconic visions I remember of the Super Bowl that you won was when you came off after the sixth touchdown and your teammates were taking the monkey off your back. Did you really have the feeling that you had a monkey on your back at the time?
Well, I appreciate that question because it really informs just the story I told you. I felt that monkey. I felt it as a mountain. I would describe it as oppressive. I think when I got done with that conversation on the plane, I suddenly realized how lucky I was. And that it really wasn't about the comparison, and it really didn't have to be a weight. It could really be an inspiration. Go see how good you can get. He actually asked me, Steve, do you want to find out how good you are? I mean, it's at risk. You might not be very good. And he said, and I said, absolutely, I want to go find out. Well, then you've got a tremendous opportunity to go find out. And so from then on, I felt pressure. I felt, you know, all the things that you'd feel in trying to achieve things. But I didn't feel that the idea that I had to replace Joe Montana, I finally felt that I'd put that aside in my mind. And so when they said, take the monkey off my back, I regret it. I regret doing it at the Super Bowl because I don't think it reflected. It was more of a elation over winning the Super Bowl than it was poignant for what it really felt like at that moment. I felt that weight, I felt lifted off maybe a few years before.
Wynn, thanks so much for the question. Rebecca in Santa Rosa. Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's on your mind for Steve?
Well, first of all, Steve, I have to say this is a thrill of a lifetime for me to get to be on a phone call with you.
Oh, thank you.
And second of all, as a parent, I want to thank you for coming out in your book and talking about your struggles with panic and anxiety. My 17-year-old daughter struggles with that also. She missed a year of school and had to go to a charter school, but she's back on track and ready to graduate. And people like you who fought through it and have had beautiful careers where you're not only successful but feel satisfied and that you made a difference with your time, you're a real role model for her, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, my gosh. It's interesting. I was nervous about, like I said, I did this to hand a narrative to my children for their benefit in the future, this that they'd say, hey, what your dad's, has some notoriety, what happened? And they could say, well, this is – my dad gave me this. This is what happened. So that's why I did it. The idea that I was going to publish, that was a whole other dilemma. Like I was like, do I really want to? Should I? And then I had some dear friends read what Jeff had done. And we decided to do it. My sweet wife, Barb, really got involved with the narrative to make sure that I got in there. And she spent an inordinate amount of time making sure that, my voice was there. And once we decided to do it, I was still nervous because people said, well, are you going to change it? Because what you did for your children, you probably want to change it for when you publish it. And I thought,
because it was so personal.
Well, I kind of live in a glass house. So I wasn't that worried about that, but it was a new thing to think about, like this is going to go out to the world, and so I was nervous about it. So even when it got published just a couple of weeks ago, I was still not sure. But I got to tell you, the number one thing that I've heard in the 2 weeks is just like the last call, just parents that have said thank you for expressing your what you've been through, because my child, my son or daughter, even me, I had a writer do an interview and say to me, Steve, I lost my first job because I could not handle a deadline. My anxiety was so great that I literally left the business. But I've come back, and now I'm actually – and he was a very successful writer. And you think, oh, my gosh, you're a well-known – like he's somebody you know. And the story is not what you'd think. And so for that part, I really appreciate that there's a usefulness, because that was all – I didn't – anyone can say, oh, it's, in Chicago, it was raining and it was cold and I threw for three touchdowns. And, I was like, that's not necessarily – might be okay for my kids, but for the general public, I felt like this was more – I appreciate the call.
Well, similar to Rebecca's point, Jordan wants to know why you think the prevalence of anxiety is in the NFL and why so many professional athletes are reluctant to speak about the issues.
I think – like anything, more so than anything, the NFL is an up or out business. The average career is 3 years. It's very difficult to keep a job. There's a lot of anxiety about staying in the league and holding on to a job. And so the last thing that you're ever going to do is reach out for, you know, if you're struggling. You're just, you know, there's too many guys waiting in the wings, you know, so you feel like maybe that's not the best thing to do. And so, and I think if, you know, the words mental illness are not fair because we all have genetics that we've kind of collected as we've in our lives. And so, you know, to me, it's probably helpful to talk about it in these terms so that it doesn't feel so strange or so scary. Or, you know, I was certainly scared when I mentioned it to Dr. Clint. I thought it took an inordinate amount of pain and anguish to get to a point where I'd say to him, if we win this game, because I said, if we lose, the last thing I'm going to do is go in and say that something's wrong. Well, of course, you just lost, you know, but if we win the game, I'm going to say something. And I remember walking off the field after we won that game against Atlanta and go, well, I'm going to say something. And that's what prompted that discussion in the locker room. And for me was, again, led to really revealing things. And so I'm if this is helpful to help people find that place where they can be successful, even the caller saying that, you know, she struggled for a year, but now is thriving, because maybe there was a knowledge and something that could people could say, you can thrive, you can do this. And that maybe is a great message.
Well, one of the other big issues in the NFL that folks are also encouraging more people to talk about is concussions, right? And it was a concussion, of course, that we mentioned at the top that ended up ending your career, a brutal hit that you took in 1999. And Deborah wants to know, you know, what Steve thinks about concussions in high school players. And I'm curious too, Steve, would you let your kids play? Do your kids play football?
So my oldest boy, Braden, 6'5", really kind of thin and just a great kid. He's an entertainer. He has a channel on Twitch. He'd want to say Braden 2011, just so, you know, he'd be disappointed if I didn't do that. B-R-A-E-D-O-N. Okay, little pitch. But he's just a great guy, and I love him. But he has really kind of opted out of sports until just a few months ago when he took up crew. And it's just changed him. He's out of the NorCal rolling, and he's just doing great things, and he's just a great guy. So he's not – I don't think – if he ever plays football, I'll be shocked. But if he did, I wouldn't be shocked in some ways, right, because he's such a capable guy. My next boy probably will, and I don't mind. As long as it's well-coached and the proper values are brought forward, I don't want him to play linebacker in the NFL for 15 years. Or even one. but playing junior high school football, as a general idea, I think it's fine. And I think that – but I understand the challenges. It's unnerving. It was unnerving when I had my concussions and I would go to the experts, the neurologists, and the questions were generally how you feel. And then you'd answer and they'd say, well, I would rest, because the brain is so – such a mystery, and it's still such a mystery in science. And so – we're getting better at least recognizing episodic concussions. So when someone comes off the field, because the players always want to go back in. I want to go back in. It's this natural reaction, the competitiveness. We're getting better at saying no, but I don't know that we're any better in, you know, making sure that we're not having long-term effects. It's hard to know.
Are you worried? I mean, you've described your injuries, right, as sort of vanilla. You have not felt any effects of
I have to say, I don't. Luckily, mine I would describe as having a concussion where you're tired, and then you rest, and you take a few days, and you feel great.
Do you worry that CTE could show up later?
100%.
You worry
about. So I think that's why, for me, when I hear other people I had a friend who had a son that was playing high school basketball, jumped and then got undercut and hit his head so hard that literally years later, he's still suffering. I've had friends say that they can't taste hot or cold. They can't remember their wife's name. They don't. So when I say vanilla, I don't want to disrespect or that's the wrong word, but that, you know, I'm very serious about it. And I thought I was pretty serious about it then. And I think that helped me make sure that I was healing. You know, I just turned 55. I want to be 85. I want to be 105. And so my life really right now, a lot of it thanks to my wife and health and eating well. And you know, I really want to live a long time. But I don't know what this is going to be like when I'm 65, 75. And I'm concerned CTE, Nina, is a scary thing. The idea that you don't even have to have a concussion, but that you could jostle your brain without episodic, you know, results And then down the road, sometime in your future, you'll have these debilitating, diagnosis.
We're talking with Steve Young, former 49ers quarterback and NFL Hall of Famer, two-time MVP, Super Bowl MVP. His autobiography with Jeff Benedict is called QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. Did you ever watch the video when you were sacked by Aeneas Williams? I heard you once say that you hadn't watched it.
I didn't for a while, and I don't think I really meant not to. It's just that was my life really changed from there. I didn't play again. And so I kind of moved on. But I don't mind watching it. In fact, it wasn't Aeneas that did it. Derek Deese was my good friend who played offensive guard for the 49ers. And I always tease him that he's the one that did it because I hit his knee. But he says it wasn't him. So no one will take total credit for it. Well, not credit, but it was an impact that I think scared people around me more than me, to be honest with you. I wasn't necessarily nearly as full of fear as Steve Mariucci. Yeah, Steve Mariucci, my coach, never really treated me. I mean, he just once that happened, he became my dad more than maybe my dad would. And so then I tell him, Mooch, I'm fine. Everything's going to be fine. And he'd be like, you could see it in his eyes. He even teared up at times, you know, like, Steve, you're too important to me. You know, and so I really retired in many ways because of the personal, sincere, and it wasn't just my coaches. I would be out in the public and people would come up to me and look me in the eye. Steve, no more. We love you. Don't do it. You know, and so like, oh, geez, I guess I can't play anymore. But I took me a long time to actually retire. But those heartfelt feelings that I got a lot informed the decision too, because I didn't want to disrespect the emotion that people had that I hard fought gained. I mean, I just threw a lot to get that feeling from, you know, most people in the Bay Area when I see them are appreciative of us both, Joe and I. I think they see, wow, we were the beneficiaries of this, two of the greats. And I know Joe's the best, so I don't mean to, but I think that they recognize that we were really lucky. I get that a lot. Very rarely do I still get, every once in a while I get, Steve, I was always for you, or I was always for Joe. But but most of the time I feel like Andy Griffith in Mayberry, where you just walk down the street and everybody just, you know, says hi.
Well, Ben asks, you're a stand-up guy and I've heard only good things about you. What do you think the NFL can do to solve some of its issues regarding players, bad behaviors off the field? I imagine he's talking about, I mean, there have been domestic violence issues in the NFL. We have this concussions issue. I also thought it was funny when you talked about that NFC championship game where at the very end of it, you were the Miller Lite player of the game, but you're a dry Mormon. And so you didn't drink at all.
Yeah, that's funny.
And yet you were a beer ad, essentially.
Right. It was funny.
What was it like to be part of the NFL mayhem and to be a dry Mormon, and also in answer to answering Ben's question about what
the league
can do?
We'll take that first. So the league, there has to be a real value. I think the one of the good things that's happened over the last 10 years is they've tried to develop a sense for the athletes that this is truly valuable. Like, you're lucky to be here, and it's something that you need to respect. And on the whole, if you think about the total numbers of guys that are playing, you don't realize how the majority of guys that are just trying to make a career, trying to raise families, taking the garbage out, you know, doing all, you know, changing diapers and doing all the things that just normal people do. And the headlines obviously are the headlines. And I think that the rank and file guys really, truly, in my experience, are trying to do the right thing and just trying to carve out a career in professional football. And the league needs to, you know, be leaders. They need to lead. They need to be the ones that don't follow the issues, especially with concussion. You know, you've seen famously in the movie that just came out recently about the issue, and you can see that the league did not take a leadership role in it. And I think they're trying to step into those shoes. The more that they do that, obviously, the more they can develop a partnership. The league needs to be partners with their players, true partners. concerned about their holistic health. I see teams that are doing great jobs of this. The Seattle Seahawks with Pete Carroll has instituted all kinds of rigor around making sure that the whole – this idea that we talked about, anxiety or other issues or whatever's going on in a player's life, they really want to try to get surrounded the player, the whole player, their families, their children and their extended families. And what can we do holistically to make your life better? Granted, to make you so that you're a better football player, but seeing that there's a value to doing that. I'm seeing teams do great things there. I think the 49ers are trying to do that as well. But so I would give the leadership role of the Seattle Seahawks and how they're doing that. Oh, and then being the Bill Miller Lite thing. So it was always, you know, I'm very respectful when it comes to religion, and very my locker rooms. I have a sense of humor about myself, and you know, guys would always, you know, even in high school, would bring milk to parties because I wanted to be at the parties. I'm not going to stay home, and so you know, we'd have chugging contests. I found out that you can't drink milk quite as fast, by the way.
You can't chug milk quite as quickly as beer. Yeah, I imagine not. Helen writes, and here's a couple of sweet stories I'd like to share with you. Helen says, Steve made the transition from Joe to him seem easy and effortless. In fact, over the years when I faced difficulties, I would say to myself, you can do this. Think of Steve Young following Joe Montana. Oh. And that gave me confidence to forge ahead. Helen, you've got Steve Young's hand over his heart right now listening to your story.
No, I'm old enough now. Like, I used to hear things. And, you know, oh, that's nice. Thank you. Or, you know, and they don't – I guess maybe it's just age. Maybe it's my kids that are growing up and I'm so concerned about them. But the idea that I've paid it forward – I Roger Staubach was my hero. His poster was right to the right of my bed on the wall. And I used to stare at it. I stared at how his fingers touched the ball, how they held it, how he would run. I would watch him when he would do interviews. I'd watch him play. I would watch everything about him. And he was so impactful for me. Many times I would say to myself, I want to be Roger Staubach, or I am Roger Staubach, you know? And so, and then one time, the first time I met him, I remember like just, well, Mr. Staubach, I'm so grateful to see you. You don't understand the impact you've had in my life and how much I watched you so closely and how, and I'm sure he felt like, oh, I don't even know you, you know? But the impact is so great. So I've been trying to pay it forward in that way, because I felt like, oh my gosh, he never knew me. He never knew who I was, but the impact was so great. And so when I hear that comment, I don't think I really took it in as much as I do today. The idea that somebody feels like, you know, what did she say? I want to do it like Steve Young. I'm like, oh my gosh, I paid it forward, and that's what I really wanted to do. And it means a lot to me. It really means a lot.
Well, let me share Amy. She says, I was 10 years old when I met you on the sideline at Candlestick. I was invited down to the field because I was the girls' state champion for the punt, pass, and kick competition.
Oh my gosh.
When I was a kid, all I wanted to be was a football player, to play for the 49ers and to be you. It wasn't until junior high that I realized as a girl playing for the NFL was likely not possible. So instead, I took up softball. I went on to get a full ride to Loyola Marymount and play for a Division I team. I struggled throughout my athletic career with anxiety, and to hear one of my idols speak out on this is truly cathartic. Could I ask you, Steve Young, why you did not end up playing for the Broncos after you were sort of forced to retire from the 49ers? You had this chance to play under Shanahan again. Your kids would have seen you play, which is something that you talked about being important to you, and you still felt like you had a lot left.
And Mike Shanahan and I, sometimes you just resonate with somebody. I mean, as a coach, as a mentor, whatever it is, he and I, we could have felt like we took over the world, you know? And so when he called me and said, he'd been coaching now and won two Super Bowls with John Elway, and John had just retired. And he called me and said, Steve, I want you to come here. And this was after all of the concussion issues that we were dealing with and everything that I felt like, you know, at that point that I'd healed and I could go do it. And I had a desire to continue to play. I really did have a desire to continue to play, because I think in many ways, until, you know, I realized what I'd been suffering from and what I had and what I was dealing with, and now I had this time, these 4 or 5 years where it's like, oh my gosh, my dad is right. It is fun. The anxiety really did wane. And it was getting better and better. And it was like, this is, I want to keep doing this. This is so much fun. And so when he offered it, I really did. And we flew into Dallas. I'm into Dallas. I'm still into the Roger Staubach story. I always joke to people when they say I'm a Dallas Cowboy fan. So was I when I was young, but then I grew out of it. So I tell people. But I flew into Denver to talk to Mike Shanahan, and we had a long conversation. And I thought that we would do it. I thought I would do it. And then I went home, and I just had this – I had this gnaw that I wanted to retire a 49er. It was big to me. Jerry was now talking about leaving and going to the Raiders. And I think he might have already signed. I can't remember. No, he played another year or two. But he was not concerned. I was like, Jerry, aren't you concerned? Don't you want to retire a 49er? And he's like, no, that's fine. I'm going to go play and keep playing. For me, I don't know what it was, Nina. I wanted to retire a 49er. Maybe because it was so – maybe because I was a Buck, you know, back in the day and what it meant to me and what had happened. And so I decided in the end I would retire a 49er. And it was – and I didn't – I said no to Mike. And I saw Mike the other day. And we talked about it again. And I said, you know what, Mike? We would have been great. But
San Francisco was home.
I decided that I was going to retire 49er.
Well, I think we have time for one last comment from Kim in Santa Rosa. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Hey, Steve. I just wanted to let you know that I started watching football in 1979 when Terry won his last Super Bowl. So I was a Steeler fan. My dad, you know, had been a Niner fan from the 50s. And when I moved back in with him, you know, Joe had already been gone, and it was you. So you were back, so I didn't quite
Oh, Kim, I think we've lost the connection with you. But one of the things that our producer saying in my ear was that Kim said that you were way bigger for her than Joe Montana.
Oh, see, I always tell people that's such a funny thing. So that you've now encapsulated in an hour of my life, like even you know today. So I appreciate it. I'm really grateful for those that because it was a transition. It was difficult, and I understand it. I mean, my gosh. I watched Joe win two Super Bowls. I watched him MVPs. I get it. So I appreciate the comment.
Well, Steve Young, it's certainly an honor to have you here in our studio today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nina. It was wonderful.
NFL Hall of Famer and former 49ers quarterback. His new memoir is called QB, My Life Behind the Spiral. And for those who want to see him, he'll be signing books at Costco in Mountain View on November 5th at noon. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our intern is Maxine Schofer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.